Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to episode 97 of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and today my guest is Naomi Harris. She's a 40-year-old British actress who began her career as a child, then broke through onto the scene in 28 Days Later back in 2002, and in the years since has starred in movies both big and small. Blockbusters that she's been a part of include Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, and Pirates of the Caribbean, At World's End, as well as two Bond movies, Skyfall and Spectre. She's also done some mid-range movies, most notably playing Winnie Mandela in Mandela: Long Walk to Freedom. But in my view, she has shined most of all in some small-budget movies, including The First Grader, a no-budget movie that she made in 2010, and most recently in Moonlight, a low-budget film from writer-director Barry Jenkins that had its world premiere at the Telluride Film Festival back in September and has become the talk of the festival circuit ever since. A24 Films will release it on October 21st. Over the course of our conversation, Harris and I talked about a wide range of subjects, including what it's been like playing a Bond girl unlike any other who came before her, why playing Winnie Mandela was such a daunting challenge, and what it was about the character that she plays in Moonlight that was more complex and demanding than any other part she'd ever played before. She opens up about why she almost turned down the opportunity, what it was like shooting her whole performance in just 3 days, and how she thinks a film that deals with major taboo subjects, particularly in the Black community, will be received upon its release. It's a fascinating conversation with a rising star who I am convinced is on her way to the Oscars, so I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Let's go to that conversation.
Naomi, thank you so much for doing this. Appreciate you coming in.
My pleasure.
To begin with, we always just ask, where were you born and raised, and what did or do your folks do for a living?
So I was born and raised in London, in Finsbury Park, which is a very multicultural area in London. And my mother was, she started off initially as a children's writer. She used to make up children's stories for me to send me to sleep. And then she actually decided to sell them. And that started her career as a writer.
That's
and
great.
She went on to write, you know, FreeStenders and had her own sitcom and so on.
Wow. From what I understand, before any script or anything ever appealed to you in terms of acting, performing that, was it originally sort of the Bible that was your your thing? Talk about with that. I mean, I've tried to read up and that was interesting.
So my... my granddad gave me this children's Bible, and I don't know why, but it just became something that I was really obsessed with. I think it was one of the first things that I could read, and it was like, it was the creation story, and I would just hold people hostage in my mom's sitting room and like just perform for them whether they liked it or not, you know?
And was there something about that? Was it the performance element or the reaction that you got? What do you think it was that maybe started this path?
I don't think it was ever about the reaction. It was always about the performance itself. I just really loved imagining that I was a different person and then creating these different worlds and inhabiting them. I used to spend hours in front of the mirror as a child doing different voices and also just trying to make myself cry as well. I don't know why. It sounds really, really strange, child.
Well, the seeds were there. But now you have talked about the fact that before really going off to theater school, I guess, you were not the happiest of children. Was that what we're talking about? Maybe just inner turmoil that maybe even you couldn't understand? What was that about?
I think the unhappiness for me really started because I was bullied at school. So that's when I became unhappy. But before then, I was very happy at primary school. Mm-hmm. So I was very happy there. But I still used to do this thing of trying to make myself cry in front of the mirror. So I think that acting bug was always there, irrespective of what happened. I think the bullying at school actually made me retreat further into that imaginary world.
What were they bullying you about?
I was bullied because basically, when I was at primary school, I was on a TV show. And it was a very successful TV show. And so I was well known as a kid. And there was just a lot of jealousy, basically. That was it.
Yeah.
You know, I started secondary school and I wanted to just kind of be like everybody else and fit in. But I already stood out because they all knew who I was. And it was just kind of fun to make fun of me.
So I have to ask, just how did that TV show come about? What was that?
So the TV show was called Simon and the Witch, and it came about because I started going to an after-school club called the Anarchia Theatre School, which is actually a really well-known theatre school in London. Mm-hmm. And what it is, it's a school that was set up by this lovely woman called Anarchia for inner-city kids to kind of have something to do after school so that they wouldn't get in trouble mm-hmm. and get into fights mm-hmm. and, you know, get involved in crime and so on. So lots of amazing actors like Pauline Quirk and so on, they all started off at the Anarchia Theatre, and it's a really beloved theatre club.
And you had enjoyed that, you felt you were benefiting from it, and that's what led to the Simon and the Witch opportunity?
Yes, so Anarchia Theatre actually had an agency attached to the theatre club, and I got joined up when I was very young, which I was very, very happy about because it was like a real achievement, you know. It was great to go to the club, but to get onto the agent's books was like amazing. So I was so excited
right,
about it.
Right.
And yeah, I went for my first ever audition, which was for this TV show, Simon and the Witch, all about a witch that comes to primary school. And all the kids know that she's a witch, but the teachers are completely oblivious.
And you're one of the kids.
And so. I was one of the kids. And yeah, and I got my first ever audition. Which was so
amazing.
It was incredible.
Afterwards, you were pretty much, I know there was the CBS series Runaway Bay.
Yes,
Runaway Now, that Bay. Was right as a result of Simon and the Witch, or were you pretty steadily working throughout your
I basically
youth?
Worked nonstop once I started. Once I started Simon and the Witch, I worked every single summer. I was only allowed to work in the summer
because I
couldn't miss too much school. But yeah, I worked every single summer doing different shows.
And it obviously didn't affect your studies too much. You ended up at Cambridge, which was a pretty nice thing. But that was also not the happiest time for you there?
No, it's really sounding like a really
no.
sad story.
It can all, it's start
Violins
low and get better.
Out. Yeah, let's get better. No, Cambridge wasn't the happiest of times because I came from a very working class background. My mum had me when she was 18 years old. She raised me on welfare for the first part of my life. So I was very, very working class. And I came from this incredibly multicultural background. As I told you before, you know, Finsbury Park is like the melting pot, you know, all different races. And I didn't even realize when I was growing up, I didn't even realize like I was black or what that meant anything, you know, because everybody was different colors, which was really beautiful, actually. And then going to Cambridge was this extraordinary experience where suddenly I was the only black person in my entire year.
Really?
In my college, at Pembroke College. And people were from completely different classes to me. They were middle class and upper middle class and aristocrats, having gone to Eton and so on. So from completely different backgrounds to mine. And I just found it such an alienating experience. I found it incredibly hard to make friends and to fit in. And yeah, it was not a happy
Do you
time.
Think it was sort of bigotry on the part of others or just a sense of not belonging that you were feeling?
I think it was just a sense of not belonging. Mm-hmm. I think I've always felt quite an outsider, and I think that really exacerbated that sense for me. And I never managed to really overcome that and really find my group while I was at university, which is such a shame because I hear people talk about university and they say, oh my God, I had such an amazing time and you know, wasn't it wonderful? And I think, oh gosh, mine wasn't like that at all. I just remember just sort of like wanting to go home every weekend, really missing my family and my friends at home.
Well, so. Those people I think might trade with you at the moment. So after Cambridge, Bristol Old Vic Theatre
School. Happier
times. Happier times.
Happier
that
times.
Was the turning point?
That was the turning point, yeah, because I was finally doing something that I really, really loved. You know, I was training to be an actress. I was with the average age in my year was actually 30.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was like 22 or 23 when I started. And so I was like the youngest there. So everyone was really mature. Everyone was incredibly dedicated. They were there just because they wanted to learn about acting. And they were really serious about it as well, which I loved. And I got to practice my craft.
Yeah.
You know? So I had a blast. It was fantastic.
But coming out of Cambridge or even while you were there, there was never any wavering about the fact that this was what you wanted to do. I mean, sometimes I would imagine with that degree or, you know, you had a lot of choices and maybe, I don't know how your mother felt about this path. Mm-hmm. Sometimes parents want the practical career. Yeah. Did you ever waver in the idea that this was what you wanted to do?
Never. I actually wanted to leave because I was, as I said, bullied at secondary school. I wanted to leave school and go straight into acting. And it was my mum who begged me to stay on at school because she said, you know, if you just get at least your A levels. I don't know what the equivalent
is. Yeah, no,
is
I know what you
States.
Mean. I guess like SATs maybe.
Okay,
like,
yeah. If you just at least pass them, then she said, if you ever want to go to university, then you have that and it just makes it easier. And I just thought, my mum has never asked anything of me, really. She's always just said, do what you want to do mm-hmm. with your life and mm-hmm. anything is possible. So I said, you know, I said to myself, if she's asking me to do this, it must be incredibly important for her. So I'll do it for her. And then I had a really inspirational teacher while I was at doing my A-levels called Mr. Murdoch. And he said, look, you have the potential to go to Oxbridge. And so it was largely because of Mr. Murdoch that I ended up going to Cambridge, because otherwise I would have gone straight into acting. So I never doubted that acting was what I was born to do.
So where chronologically did what I believe was your big break? And I guess you were probably only just a few months out of drama school when you mm-hmm. got this break with 28 Days Later, right?
I was actually 9 months out of drama school. So I'd spent 9 months being unemployed.
Which is pretty short for people, right?
It's really short, but at the time, it doesn't feel that way. Especially when you've been a child actor and you've been working nonstop. Yeah. And so, you know, I left drama school and I thought, okay, it's going to be the same. You know, I'll just get an audition, get a job. And I auditioned, and I auditioned, and there was no's. And so it was a really scary time for me, actually. And the only job I got was, I got this tiny theatre job. And I actually, the train ride to the theatre each day was more than what I was being paid. I think I was paid £30 a week.
So it was a loss for you to do this.
So but. To go from that to then getting the call from Danny Boyle and being, you know, auditioned by him and him actually championing me, because he was the one who, after my first audition, said, this is the girl that I want. And he rang me at home and he said, I want you to come back, but you sound too posh for this role. So, you know, work on the accent, come back, but you're the one that I want. So.
Now, how did he even know you existed? Was there an agent or somebody that connected you guys?
I had an agent at the time. I got an agent when I left drama school, and my agent just put me forward. I didn't even know when I was auditioning that it was actually for the lead role. So it was all a bit of a massive shock, really. And also, I didn't really know who Danny Boyle was at that point. So once I did my research, once I'd got the role, then I was kind of so shocked.
A little intimidated.
So over the moon and really intimidated as well.
The other aspect, I guess, of preparing to play that character was a lot of physical preparation, right, for that one?
Yeah, there was a lot of physical preparation because, you know, Selena, the character that I played, this machete wielding woman, she's really, really tough. So I had to learn to do a lot of stunt works, and my love affair with stunts began
there. Yeah, it all became in use. But now Danny is kind of well known, I think, for doing a lot of takes. Was that
I did not know that. That's so funny, because Danny seems like nothing, because I worked with Michael Mann.
Oh.
So, and Michael Mann
that's
loves
a lot of takes.
To do
oh
like
my God.
A minimum of 20 takes.
So Danny
takes.
Didn't jar
so,
you.
No,
yeah.
Danny was like easy
right.
for me.
That same year, 2002, or at least coming out the same year as 28 Days Later, was White Teeth.
One of my favorite roles.
And you've talked
played.
About that almost some in some ways, I think, being a break in its own way. Maybe it's not as well known of a movie, but it was for you a particularly gratifying one?
Yeah. You know, it's really exciting when you find characters within yourself that you never knew were there, you know, and I just found that character, she's just so completely far removed from me that actually it was terrifying in the beginning, because I thought, how am I ever going to reach her?
Right.
How am I going to do this accent? That's when I found that the real joy in acting is always to be scared, and is always to take something that really challenges you, to push you outside of your comfort zone. Because when you find characters like that, you grow as a person.
Mm-hmm. For people who haven't seen that, can you just tell a little bit about who this character was, Clara? Because it did require a lot of, as you're saying, a lot of work on your part.
Clara was this very, she'd grown up with this very repressive parents. And so she is from Jamaican background, and she meets this guy and sort of is sexually liberated by him and starts to come out of her shell and finally blossom into being a woman.
Mm-hmm. Now, that movie, even 28 Days Later, these are, you know, you're starting to do, I guess, bigger and bigger movies, but nothing really, I guess, could have probably prepared you for the Pirates experience, because these are massive, massive studio movie. So just to begin, I mean, you did in 2006, Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, then 2007, Pirates of the Caribbean, World's End. I don't know if maybe they were even shot together at the same...
No, they weren't. There was a massive break in between them, actually, yeah.
But how did that come about, and was it something that you knew you wanted to do? Did you know what you were signing up for with such a big kind of thing?
So basically that came about because I was asked to come and audition, but the director Gore was quite honest about the fact that actually he didn't think I was right for it. And so it was kind of like, come in on audition, but you're not going to get the part, you know, because he already had someone in mind, and he always imagined that she was a very voluptuous character, mm-hmm. which I'm not. And so, you know, he had this very strong image in his mind, and I read for him, and he said, "I like it. You know, do you want to come to the Caribbean and shoot this?" And I was like, "Yeah, absolutely." So that was an amazing experience because I managed to change his mind,
yeah,
you know, there
awesome.
And then in the room. And Tia Dalma is one of my favorite roles that I've ever played.
Why? Talk about it.
I love the creation process when I'm creating characters. And what I loved about Tia Dalma is that she's not constrained by reality at all. She can be absolutely anything. And she can change, you know, at a whim's notice and become sad or happy or angry. Or, you know, she's not limited at all by societal constraints. And those are the roles which I enjoy playing most because they're the most fun. They're the most freeing.
Right. Now, continuing this pattern of going back and forth between very small, very big movies, one of the nicest movies that I think people can check out is The First Grader, which is probably, do you remember what the budget was on that? It must have been...
I don't even remember the budget.
Minuscule, though, right?
Yeah, really small.
And
really small.
This is Justin Chadwick, the filmmaker who ended up going on to other things as well. But basically, here you are working with, I think, 80 Kenyan children,
yep,
right?
That's right.
And
yeah.
This has got to be unlike anything else you've... And in a no-budget movie, I don't know where it was shot, but it must have been an interesting one.
Yeah, it was really one of the most heartwarming experiences for me, and one of those experiences where you really get an insight into a community that you would never normally in everyday life have access to. So basically, Justin said he wanted to film documentary style, and these children came from such poor homes that, you know, they'd never really even seen televisions. You know, they barely, lots of them didn't have shoes. The only meal that they ate was the one meal a day that they got at school. So for them to have a camera in their school, they didn't really understand what it all kind of meant. So because of that, we were able to introduce me as a new teacher. And that's how they saw me. They called me Teacher Jane, and they really thought I was Teacher Jane. And so often, like in takes, a little child would come up and say, "Miss, I've done my homework," you know, because they really thought, you know, this was just school for them. And so for 2 weeks before we actually started shooting, I taught these 80 children. They were my class. And, you know, I trained as a teacher with, you know, the other teachers in the school. And that was really, really incredible. And it was most incredible because they were so hungry to learn and are so appreciative of everything. You know, they'd play with just a rock in break time. And they'd come up with all these imaginative games and spend hours just playing with, like, just rocks. And I just thought of my brother and sister, who are 20 years younger than me, who I love dearly, but, you know, they have all these gadgets and all the most expensive toys, and they're bored. They're always bored, you know. It was such a huge education.
How did that movie, once it came out, how do you think it affected them, if at all, and how did the experience affect you going forward?
It affected me because I realized that what I really like is immersive experiences and experiences that really stretch me and where I get to really learn something and grow as a person, because ultimately I think the two have to go hand in hand. And I think as a performer, you're always trying to grow, you know, and the more access to different areas of life that you have, more experience of different areas of life, I think the better the actor that you become.
Going back then, pretty soon after that, to another blockbuster was the beginning of Moneypenny with Skyfall.
Yes.
Did you ever imagine you would be in a Bond movie? And was that even something that some people dream of, certain things in the movies? This is just a kind of probably experience unlike any other.
Yeah. you know, I never dreamed of being in a Bond movie because I never thought it was a possibility because, you know, the Bond girls up until that point had been usually in their 20s. And also they'd have certain assets, you know, that voluptuous figure that I just don't have, you know, I'm more like a stick insect. So I just thought I'll never be offered that kind of role. So it was really weird to me when I got asked to come in and meet Sam Mendes and I was auditioning with him and he was like seriously considering me. And I when I first went in, I just thought, well, you know, they're auditioning. I know they audition thousands of actresses. Right, right. They go all around the world. I thought this is a whole thing. You know, I'm just being brought in just to pad up the numbers. And then Sam said, no, you know, it's down between you and just two other women. And I was like, seriously? That doesn't make any sense to me. Wow. I didn't understand.
And was it and exciting, then, the prospect, though, of that coming through? Or
I would was have been perplexed.
Yeah, right,
because I
right.
just thought, I just don't see it. Right. And then when they sat me down and, you know, Barbara and Michael and mm-hmm. Sam said, you know, actually, this role, she starts off and you think she's a Bond girl, and then she ends up as Miss Moneypenny. And I thought, oh, that makes a lot more sense.
They need an actress now. They don't, the assets are not all they need. So.
Exactly.
Right. So the other thing that kind of distinguishes her from a lot of other Bond girls, or as I know you began referring to them in the promotion, Bond women, mm-hmm. was that she's sort of going through the same kinds of things that he is. She's taking the same risks, making the same sacrifices. From that point of view, was it easier to, or more comfortable to go out and then subsequently promote and talk about these movies, knowing that it is sort of a Bond for the 21st century, not in any way just sort of a...
She's not arm candy.
No.
You know, she's not at all. She's, you know, she's going toe-to-toe with him, and she's grappling with the same issues that he's grappling with. And I love that. And she's feisty, and she's witty, and she gives as good as she gets. Mm-hmm. And for all of those reasons, I love her. Mm-hmm. And I loved playing with her. And I also loved working with Daniel as well. You know, I think he's an extraordinary actor. And I think he is the best modern Bond that we've had.
Yeah.
So for all of those reasons, it was an incredible experience for me.
And was there ever any doubt that you would be back, I guess, 3 years later with Spectre? Or you were excited to keep going?
No, I was really excited to keep going. Yeah. You know, working on the Bond franchise is like unlike any other experience that I've ever had, because people talk about, you know, making this kind of community when you make a film and, you know, having friends on set and what have you. But really, when you make a Bond movie, it's really like you join a family. And it genuinely is like that, because at the helm you have Barbara and Michael, mm-hmm. this brother and sister team, and there's so much love between them, obviously. And they are continuing the legacy of their father, mm-hmm. Cubby Broccoli, yeah. who started this whole franchise. So there's so much love poured into it. And they really treat you as though you are a member of the family. Still, every year, every birthday, Barbara always remembers my birthday. Every Christmas, I get this huge hamper from her. You know, I get invited to family lunches with her.
That's great.
And you really... Yeah, you really just feel like you are part of this incredible family that people feel so passionately about, and they're so happy to be part of and so committed. And so that's a real luxury, because in filmmaking, there's no continuity. You're like a gypsy traveling around the world with your suitcases, and there are all these new faces.
Yeah.
And so to be able to go back and work with this amazing team who are so gorgeous, and it's something very special, and I definitely would never want to give that up.
Well, so I'm just trying to recall here off the top of my head how we left it with Moneypenny at the end of Spectre. Is there any reason we wouldn't be seeing you in an additional installment?
No, there's not. I didn't get blown up.
Okay,
or
good. I believe that would have been awkward. So. Now, I wonder though, I guess probably starting with the Pirates films and then certainly with the Bond films, your recognizability in the world changed a lot, and you have made it very clear the reasons why you got into this stuff, but with the exposure comes additional baggage, and I just wonder how you adjusted to being a well-known person, and if you are still able to enjoy what you do as much, or if it became an impediment.
So it's really interesting, actually, because people kept asking me that, and have kept asking me that for a long time, and genuinely nothing changed.
Really?
When I did Pirates, because obviously I was wearing so much makeup, and the dreadlocks and the black goo oozing out of my mouth and all that kind of stuff, I wasn't recognizable.
Right.
So nobody associated me with my role. And also, you know, 28 days later as well, I had a very different haircut, a very short, tomboyish haircut. And also, I'm completely different to Selena I'm not machete wielding or tough or, you know what I mean, in everyday life.
Right.
So again, people didn't recognize me at all. It's only changed within the last, I would say, year and a half with, I think, Spectre for some reason. I don't know why, but...
Yeah, because it didn't do it with Skyfall, but it did it with Spectre.
Yeah, I really don't...
That's weird.
Yeah, it's really weird. I'm not sure what's happened, but now I get recognized a lot.
And how do you deal with it? I mean, are people generally good about it, or are you dealing with weirdos and whack jobs and the usual?
No, I haven't had any weirdos at all.
Right.
People are just incredibly generous and just want to congratulate you and say they love your work and just take a photo with you and, you know, which is, you know, I'm not bombarded. I'm not like, I don't know, Johnny Depp or something, you know, where you can't walk down the street.
Right.
I'll just have maybe two, maybe three people a day who'll say, I really like your work, Naomi. And that's actually a really nice thing, you know? So far it hasn't been problematic at all. It's actually just been really lovely.
And it's
also a privilege as well to be able to brighten someone's day, you know, just by taking a photo with them. It actually makes them feel so happy. So
was there somebody like that when you were a kid, when you were, you know, discovering movies or TV or whatever, who would have been the person
for
you?
Michael Jackson.
Really?
Yeah, without a doubt. I spent hours listening to his music,
really?
Like every day. I used to imagine that he would pick me up from school. And like, I was obsessed. I used to paint pictures of me and Michael Jackson and send them to him, to the fan club.
Yeah.
And it was so annoying because I did this film called After the Sunset with Brett Ratner.
Yeah.
And Brett Ratner was best friends with Michael Jackson at the time. And he was due to come on set. And I remember I was just like, this would be every dream of mine come true if Michael Jackson came on set. And I never got to meet him.
Because that was around the time that he passed away?
I think he was ill at the time. Mm-hmm. And then, he passed away. So,
well, that's maybe in a weird respect, maybe it's good to remember him the way that you remember him.
From all my posters.
Yeah, right. I think that speaking of, you know, heroes, or sounds like one of your heroes, you were a part of a movie about one of probably the greatest hero of my lifetime, who was Nelson Mandela. My mom's South African. So I grew up knowing about this guy. And then to see a Mandela Long Walk to Freedom, his autobiography essentially made into this film in 2013, was really exciting. And then to see you as Winnie was particularly nice. And I guess in terms of the director, a reunion, right, for you with, this was Justin again. But when you first heard that somebody wanted you to play Winnie Mandela, what was your reaction?
Terror.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where I was really terrified when I got offered the role, because I just thought she's a living icon to many people. And it's always tricky portraying someone who's living as well, because there is even more expectations about how they should be played. And then I started to research her, and then it became even more terrifying because I realized that she's such a divisive character and people see her in such radically different ways. You know, some people see her as this saint, Mother Earth figure leading this movement, and others as literally a murderer, the devil, an embezzler, all these kind of things. And I was like, how am I going to marry these two opposing views of who this woman is? And where do I find this woman in the middle of all of that as well? Like, who ultimately is she? Because it seems like they're talking about two completely different people. So it was a really scary experience. But what helped me was actually sitting down with Winnie. And I said, you know, how do you want to be portrayed? And I expected her to say, well, show me as the saint,
of course.
And I'd feel like, well, I'm constrained a little because, you know, you know, the producers have sat me down with her and she said this, so I've got to do this.
Right.
But actually she gave the power back to me, which I thought was incredibly generous. And she just said, play me as you see fit, because you have been chosen because you're right for this role. So you do your research and you play me as you want.
And it ended up being, though, still, even with that permission, where would this rank in terms of the most challenging parts you've played?
Oh my gosh, definitely one of the most top two.
Yeah,
100% top two, yeah.
And what was the secret in the end to navigating that? I mean, navigating that line between hero and villain, in a sense, you know, how did you figure out how to do it?
I think she's both. Mm-hmm. I think she really is both, mm-hmm. you know, and I wanted to portray both of those things, which was a little bit of a struggle, I have to say, with our producers, because they are very good friends with Winnie Mandela, mm-hmm. and particularly Anansing, you know, and that's how he got the rights
right.
to the film project, right. was because of that relationship. So he felt he wanted to portray her in a very particular light.
Right.
And I always think, as a performer, my job is to get to the heart of, you know, I've got to be like a detective and get to the truth,
right.
you know. And I was just lucky enough that I was working with Justin, who allowed me the freedom to explore
right.
both ranges of who she is.
Did you ever speak with her after the film was seen by her?
I did, and she was in tears. It was in South Africa after the South African premiere.
Wow.
She said she never wanted to see it again, but she said it was almost like I had somehow found a way of channeling her life
wow.
and channeling her on screen. And she said no one had ever depicted her better.
That's a hell of a compliment.
So
that's great.
I was like, job done.
Yeah,
yes.
That's awesome. So one thing that I guess emerged as we go through these films is that you have a Meryl Streep-like ability to do these accents. We've got Calypso, we've got Jamaican, we've got South African, I'm sure I'm leaving out others. Is that something that just kind of comes easily?
No, it doesn't come easily, but I like it. You know, I like playing characters that are, as the further the character is away from me, the more comfortable I become. I don't really like playing things that are very close to me. So an accent adds another layer of, you know, removing them from me. And it's also a great way of, because, you know, accents give you different ways of rhythms of speech. They also change the way that you can express yourself as well. They're kind of limiting as well as giving you freedom as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that because it forces me to think in a different way if I've got a different accent as well. But it is always scary because there's never enough time because you usually don't have very much preparation
time
for a movie. So the accent is the basic because you have to get that and then completely forget about it.
Do you have a default way of doing it? Are you just listening over and over to tapes or something? Or what do you do?
I find what really helps me is to work with an accent coach because they hear things which I can't hear and they can explain them in a way that someone with the accent can't really explain it because
mm-hmm.
they can't hear themselves. So that really helps me initially. And then it's to immerse myself. So what I do is like in South Africa, I just hung around with people who had the kind of accent that
right.
we had.
Right.
And I did the accent the whole time with them until I got over the point where I felt awkward. You know, I just did it all the time.
Right.
And I did it all the time on set
right.
as well until the point where I could get to the point where I could switch backwards and forwards between my own and the accent, then I would let it go and I could, you know, be myself on set. But until that point, I was playing Winnie the whole time.
Right. Well, if playing somebody very different from yourself is where you feel most comfortable, I think you probably, in one sense, not every sense, but in one sense, probably felt very comfortable with Moonlight because everything about this woman seems far removed from you. This, to set the scene, this is the crack-addicted mother, Paula, of this boy who we are seeing grow up over a period of like 20 years. And I guess before we talk anything further about the movie, just how did the material even first cross your radar? And did you already know who Barry Jenkins, the writer-director, was? Because his only prior movie was like 8 years ago and not widely seen.
Yeah. I was presented with the material. It came from Jeremy Kleiner, the producer of Moonlight. And he'd wanted me to do another project that he'd been working on, but it hadn't kind of worked out. So he suggested me to Barry and sent me the script. And I read it and I cried my eyes out. I thought, this is such a beautiful script. But I didn't know anything about Barry Jenkins. So then I went and watched, because you can find Barry's first film, Medicine for Melancholy.
Where did you find it? I'm trying to find
YouTube.
It. YouTube, really?
It's on YouTube in four parts. You can just, download
That's
it.
That's good
to
know.
It's great. So I watched it, and I couldn't believe it was made for $17,000. And it is, hands down, one of the best films that I've ever seen.
Wow.
It's so beautifully shot and so moving and so original as well that I just thought, this is a filmmaker that I want to work with.
And that being said, when you were presented with this definite offer to do it, was it an obvious yes for you, or was there some hesitation?
No, there was quite a bit of hesitation because, you know, I've always said that as an actor, you don't have very much choice. So, you know, you're not producing the material yourself, you're not writing it, and you're not directing it. And what you do with your work is you hand it over to somebody else to dissect. You know, the editors pull it apart, the director does what he wants with it. So the only area of real power that you have is about what you choose to do material-wise. And I'd always said at the very beginning of my career that I wanted to make a real effort to portray women in a very positive light, and also particularly black women in a positive light. And I'd always drawn the line, therefore, at playing a crack addict, because I thought there are enough stereotypical roles out there. I don't want to add another one to the mix. And then here I was, presented with this amazing role and this amazing script and an amazing film director, but it was playing a crack addict. So I was really hesitant about taking on the role. But I spoke to Barry Jenkins. We had a Skype call, and I said, you know, I'm not sure I want to take this on. And he said, Naomi, I don't want to ask you to play another stereotype, but the reality is, this is my mother's story. This is Terrell, the writer's mother's story as well. So what do? We want to tell our story, and we have to include our mothers. So we have to find a way of telling her story that's non-stereotypical. And I thought, I've never had anyone ask me to play their mother, first of all. And also, number two, I thought, well, they have a vested interest in making sure that she's not a stereotype, that I'm given a real opportunity to portray this woman, but with showing all the multi-layers and complexities and humanity as well that she has.
In terms of even just making it logistically possible for you to do this, that was going through a lot of hoops too. From what I saw, Jeremy at Telluride, where this movie premiered, and he gave me a little bit of insight into what happened. Can you share what you had to do to just be able to show up on set?
So what happened was, I was doing for the promotional tour for Spectre. So I was in a different country every 3 or 4 days promoting the movie. And I don't know how it worked out. I think it was to do with visa issues. There was something happening at the visa office at that time where they just weren't issuing visas. Mm-hmm. It seemed as though it was really touch and go whether I would actually do this movie. Mm-hmm. And it ended up being that all we had was 3 days to shoot the whole thing.
So you were at these junkets for Spectre.
Yes.
And between each city, you would have like a day? Or how would it work with that? Because I know the thing that blew my mind was that you did this part in just 3 days.
Yeah, no. We did it in 3 consecutive days.
3 consecutive days.
Yeah, that's the only window that I had.
So because of the visa issue, you weren't able to go off to wherever you were
supposed to go? No, I wasn't, because I think I was supposed to shoot it in over maybe 6 days or something like that, and fly in and fly out again, but it didn't work out. So it ended up being just 3 days where we had to cram in absolutely everything.
That's insane. And obviously, I would assume that means no rehearsal time.
No, there's no rehearsal.
And additionally,
no getting to know the other characters, no getting to know my sons.
Yeah, because you've got three actors playing your son.
And, you know, little Alex as well, who's never acted before and is only 11 years old.
So how do you overcome that when you show up and you got to get right into it?
You do a hell of a lot of research, you know, because I knew that I was going to go in and I had to hit the ground running and I had to be fully prepared. So, you know, YouTube is an amazing mine of information. Yeah. It's extraordinary. You can find anything on YouTube. So I was watching back-to-back documentaries about crack addiction, crack addiction in Miami in the 80s, interviews with crack addicts, and just exploring, because the hardest aspect for me to crack was this whole area of addiction to drugs, because I'm very clean living. I don't, you know, I don't smoke, I don't drink any alcohol, and I don't even drink coffee. So like, to go from me to full-blown crack addiction was something really hard to get my head around. But what really helped me, there were two things that really helped me. First of all, there was a woman who described the way that addiction comes about, and she described it as being like starting a relationship with a psychopathic lover. And that really made sense to me, because what she said in the beginning, the drugs make you feel amazing. You feel so, you know, at peace. You feel so joyful, so confident. All the emotions that you'd want to feel, you suddenly feel. You're on this euphoric high. But then once the drugs get their hold on you, then they start to abuse you and to destroy you and to take from you. And that, for me, was a real insight into what it meant to be really, you know, have an addiction, because I thought I could really understand it's like a demon has almost possessed you and taken you over. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that really helped me was that I started to notice that every single one of the women that were addicted had the same story. They'd all been either raped or sexually abused as children. And that for me, again, was like, I started to analyze, how did this addiction start? And I thought, they're running away from their pain. it's almost like they haven't been able to come to terms with it. They're so emotionally damaged that they have this facade of being okay on the outside and functioning, but actually inside there's an emotional well of pain. And they are using the drugs to numb that pain and to escape from that pain. And then I could really relate to that because I just thought, we're all doing that on some levels. You know, we're all just using more socially acceptable ways of doing it and less destructive ways of doing it. But that for me was my real connection point with her. And I realized that we're actually, none of us are really that far away from addiction ourselves.
That is all valuable from a psychological point of view, but from the actual physical presentation of somebody who's crack addicted, obviously you've now seen it from those that footage, but what were you specifically doing, or I don't know if imitating is even the appropriate word, but mimicking in a sense from what you'd seen? What were your ways into the physicality?
So there are two things one thing I want to say is that I worked with this amazing accent coach called Tim Monick. Mm-hmm. He was incredible. Okay. So we did all the sessions over Skype because, as I said, I was traveling and in different hotel rooms. So I never got to meet Tim.
Wow.
I still haven't met Tim. But so thank you, Tim. Yeah. You really helped me. So that was one thing. And then in terms of the physicality, what I noticed from watching these women was almost like, it was like drugs took the lid off of what was socially acceptable behavior. So they were very erratic. Suddenly they would be shouting. Suddenly they would stand up in interviews. They would hit something, throw something, and then next minute be calm and rational and relatively normal. Mm-hmm. And I loved that because as a performer, because I thought, wow, that's so exciting. You could just be totally free, And I loved exploring that. And so I was like a crazy woman in these different hotel rooms all around the world, shouting, jumping on beds, throwing things, banging things, and exploring her physicality as well, exploring the physical damage that drugs do to your body because they ravage your body.
People should know that this movie is broken into three chapters years apart, and you are the only performer who appears throughout all three chapters. Yeah. I assume you had to break down how she was different in many different ways in each of these chapters, because particularly when you're only around for 3 days to make the movie, I'm guessing it wasn't done in sequence.
It was not.
Which has got to be brutal when you're playing somebody who's essentially devolving into, maybe in some ways becoming more enlightened mentally, but physically you're not going to get any healthier from this. So what, in your mind, was the breakdown for how she changed over the different chapters?
So in chapter one, she's got a facade of, as she's holding down a good job, she's a nurse, and she's doing a good job of looking after her son as well, but she has this secret, that she's keeping from everyone. So that's how I saw her in the beginning. And she also looks healthy and, well and, able to move well and so on. And in chapter two, then she's in full-blown addiction. She's like the worst you can possibly be. And her mind is only thinking about drugs. Right. She has lost all ability to really care and connect with her son. And she's at the worst state you could be. And physically as well, the drugs are starting to ravage her body. And then in chapter three, it's the point where she's in rehab. You only see her once actually in chapter three. And she is full of remorse for the ways that she has damaged her son.
If you had to guess, and I know this is always a tricky question, but after the credits roll, what becomes of this lady?
I think where you see her in the final chapter is where she stays. I think that she does manage to keep her addiction in check, and that's because she dedicates her life to helping other people with addiction. Mm-hmm. So she has a reason to live, and she has a way of escaping her pain, which is by helping other people through their own pain. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the beautiful messages about the film, actually, for me, is that I think to play a character well, you have to, on some level, fall in love with them, or at least have great compassion for them. And in the beginning, I had a lot of judgment about Paula and her addiction. But what I realized from doing my research and going on the journey with her is that actually she's doing the very best she can It's just she doesn't have the resources to do any better. She doesn't have the support to do any better. And in the final chapter, we see that finally she's got some help. So she can change her life. She can turn things around. And it's a really inspiring message. You know, it's a hopeful message that actually people with the right support can do better and can radically change.
Was there a scene that you found to be the toughest one, tougher than the others?
I think the middle stage was the toughest for me. I think my very first scene in the movie that I shot was when I was in full-blown crack addiction mode and really behaving in a very kind of psychotic, crazy way.
Is this when she's taking money from her son?
Exactly. Yeah. So that was the first scene that I shot. And to kind of go from naught to me, Naomi,
right.
to this right. jump to this really deranged woman as she is at that stage. Yeah, that was very, very challenging because, you know, you've really got to throw yourself into it and be willing to make a fool of yourself.
How early on in those 3 days did you realize that you were doing something special out of the ordinary and that you were part of something special? Maybe that part you can't know until you see the movie, but you've got to have a read on yourself that this is not, you know, you're not phoning it in here. So what was your first realization that this was going to be a special one?
I don't think you ever know. I think you're right in saying that you never know that the film as a whole is going to be special. But I knew before I'd got to set that I'd found something and connected with something that was very different from anything else that I'd ever connected with. I managed to find a level of connection with Paula that I didn't think it was possible to find a connection with, especially because she is so different.
Yeah.
But I found it very easy actually to be in her skin. I was very comfortable there. And also I found so much love for her and also love for my son as well. So maybe the final scene when we're in rehab together and he comes and ask him to let down his walls and I apologize to him for being a bad mother. I think that for me, I just felt something in my own heart just kind of crack.
Yeah. You know? When did you first see the movie and what were your reactions?
So I first saw the movie with my family before the music had been added and so on, and it was a very rough cut. And despite that, my family, who are my harshest critics, never ever hold back
from
telling me if I'm and they were completely silent. They were all in tears, and we were in a car journey back home, and they spent the whole journey just saying, that was a brilliant film.
Wow.
And we completely loved it. And my brother is actually a film student and he was dissecting the directing and the cinematography and he was just saying it's extraordinary. And so that's when I thought, wow, this must be good.
You got something
I've
here.
Never known my entire family to agree on anything
right?
I've ever done before.
Oh, that's so funny. It's rolling out at the film festivals. I just saw it again at the New York Film Festival. How do you think the general public and the Black community are going to respond to this movie? Because in both the larger group and that smaller group, this is dealing with some subjects that are still pretty taboo.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder what your sense is. Obviously, those of us who are looking at it from a purely cinematic point of view, I haven't met one person that didn't like this movie.
Mm.
But it's going to rock the boat, I would think, right?
I think those people who don't see the movie are going to may well have, you know, judgments about what it's like. But I think anybody who sees this movie cannot fail to be deeply affected by it. And it's one of these movies that is so subtle, it just manages to get under your skin and to affect your heart. So you come with all these kind of judgments about, you know, your views of what is right, what is wrong, and morally correct and so on. And then it actually just connects with you on such a deep, profound level that you can't help but to be moved. And you can't help but to grow from the experience of watching this movie.
Mm-hmm. Last few questions are just sort of big picture ones, but I just wonder how gratifying it's been for you to hear the reaction to your performance. I mean, you've gotten lots of great feedback over the course of your career, but I think this has got to be at a level that is new even to you. Are you feeling that yet? Are you getting that sense? Has it reached you?
I'm getting the sense that people really, you know, like it and love the movie. And but I don't read reviews.
Okay.
I always make it a point not to read reviews. Because I just think, you know, if you start believing the good, then you have to believe the bad.
Right. Which could be dangerous.
Sorry, which could be very dangerous. And I see people being affected. You know, I in Telluride in particular, I had one girl who came up to me afterwards and she started to talk about the movie and she just burst into tears and she ended up in my arms just sobbing. And that's so rewarding because ultimately that's what you want. You want to be part of a film that affects people that deeply, that it's possible that it kind of creates some change. And I think that this movie is powerful enough to do that. Mm-hmm. And that's what I find really exciting.
And so finally, just with the reception that this movie is getting, which is only going to be seen by more and more people in the coming months, it seems like, hopefully, and I would bet a lot that people's appreciation for you and your abilities is only going to increase. And I just wonder, with that, if you could do anything you wanted with the next couple of chess moves or whatever of your career, what would that be? Is there anything specifically you're anxious to do?
Gosh, that's a really hard one. Oh my gosh, you've stumped me now. I don't know what to say. You know, I just think I've been so fortunate to work with incredible filmmakers who have such vision and have really pushed and pulled me and helped me to grow that I just want to continue that journey. I just always want to get better, do better, do better work. So yeah, I think I just want to continue to work with great filmmakers, really, who helped me to be the best actress I possibly can be.
All right. Well, the word is out there. Contact her. You can look IMDb Pro it. Thank you so much. I really appreciate
it. Thank you. That was really fun. Thank you.